We want to take a second to thank you for supporting Womance by listening to our podcast.
One great way that you can continue supporting us, including those listens, is hitting subscribe, telling a friend, leaving a review. That stuff all really matters.
Sharing it on your personal social media is another great way to spread the word about Womance. And another option for supporting us, if we may be so bold, is to recommend going to our Patreon, where you can donate as little as a dollar a month to help us spread the word of woe.
If you want to contribute more than a dollar a month, which obviously no pressure, whatever you've got, we are so appreciative to have, but we have awesome gifts for you. If you want a hand-addressed letter from Morgan and Isabeau, maybe with some special woe stickers, other merch.
Just visit our Patreon. We are Womance on Patreon, or is it patreon.com/womance? We would be very proud to call you one of our patrons.
I'm Isabeau.
I'm Morgan.
And this is Womance,
a podcast about romance novels,
about werewolves,
about interspecies politicking,
about some undisclosed, vaguely Nevada-ish place in the United States.
About romantasy.
About smelling your mate.
About drinking blood through a straw.
About pretending that you hate kids but actually really loving them.
About traditionalist radicalization.
About open beams
and closed relationships.
But mostly it's about that first thing.
Romance novels
and
ourselves.
This week, friends, listeners, enemies, we're reading Bride by Allie Hazelwood.
Yeah. This is not the first Allie Hazelwood we've read. We did also read her breakout fan fiction come Berkeley release.
Rey and Kylo fic. Dressed yeah. up in the trappings of the Academy.
It wasn't Love and Other.
Yeah, the Love Hypothesis.
The Love Hypothesis. The novel that gets cited as like on the cover of this book is actually Love Theoretically, which was the follow-up novel. Mm-hmm. Allie Hazelwood has also published some novellas you and I talk about, we really enjoy, which are also very clear fic. Mm-hmm. And this book owes a lot to fan fiction as well.
Sure does. Sure does.
Shall I read the back of the book?
I wish you would, Morgan. I wish you would.
Then I shall. A vampire bride and an alpha werewolf form a dangerous alliance. Whoa. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I do want to point out, it did line break after form. Okay?
Okay.
And you can't just line break on people. You have to have intentionality with
it's
the
like
shape
poetry.
of your words. Yeah, absolutely. Especially if it's centered text. I'm going to try again.
Okay.
But I just want everyone to know that I was doing a good job. The book was doing a bad job. A vampire bride and an alpha werewolf form a dangerous alliance in this enthralling new paranormal romance. Misery Lark, a daughter of a powerful vampire councilman. It's vampire with a Y. So you know it's serious. It's not for kids. Is an outcast. Her days of living anonymously among the humans are over. She has been called upon to uphold an alliance between the vampires and their mortal enemies, the Wares. Wares are ruthless and unpredictable, and their alpha, Lo Morland, is no exception. He rules his pack with absolute authority, but not without justice or feeling. It's clear from the way he tracks Misery's every movement that he doesn't trust her. Only he knew how right he was. Misery has her own reasons to agree to this marriage of convenience, reasons that have nothing to do with police, to do with politics or alliances, and everything to do with the only thing she's ever cared about, and she is willing to do whatever it takes to get back what's hers. Get ready. Hazelwood unleashes her sparkling voice and wit on a paranormal Romeo and Juliet, international best-selling author, Ruby Dixon. Allie Hazelwood finally gives us paranormal with her trademark humor, twisty plot, and spice that doesn't quit. Buckle up, New York Times bestselling author Hannah Witten.
We like Hannah Witten.
We talked about her novel For the Wolf, if you want to listen to that episode. It's a very good, like, I think it's one of our like more relaxing episodes, if that's what you're into.
That's true.
We were quite chill and mellow when we talked about.
It's so much loam. It's just like being in the forest.
It's true. It's very soily. I also think Hannah Witten makes a good point here. This is paranormal.
Yep.
I said romantasy, but I think paranormal is a much better fit for what this text is. Mm-hmm. I've just been so caught up in the zeitgeist.
I think paranormal and romantasy like share things in the Venn diagram. And they like, they're, you know, they're like cuddly. They're like kissing kin.
Yeah. Isabel and I actually each bought this book
separately.
Separately. Without consulting each other first or anything like that. We got it for our own pleasure. One of the reasons is I do think Allie Hazelwood is a sparkling wit, as Ruby Dixon pointed out. Ruby Dixon wrote Ice Planet Barbarians, if y'all were wondering why she's... I mean, gosh, the bigger her books, the cooler the kids at the table are on the blurbs, I guess.
That seems right, though.
But we bought it separately. I bought it because I really liked Allie Hazelwood, and I had seen her mention that this was a knotting novel. K-N-O-T-T-I-N-G. Why did you want to read the book?
Because I like Allie Hazelwood a lot, and I was in the Midway Airport at 4:30 in the morning traveling with a toddler, and I saw it, and I was like, oh, this will be perfect. I'll never get to read it on this vacation I'm about to not relaxingly have, but I'll like it when the brief moments of whatever. And so I was like, absolutely, one click with my in real life hand. And I went
I was like, you saw in an airport, you bought it on Amazon.
No, I went to purchase it, and the woman behind the kiosk was like, oh, this book is so funny. And I was like, yeah, I'm excited. And she goes, it's a romance. And I was like, yeah, no, I know. And she's like, I never read a romance before. I didn't really know that this was a romance when I picked it up. And I was like, oh,
okay.
Really? That's a weird thing to say at 4:30 in the morning. She's like, well, you know, romance can be so heavy. I was like, okay. And she's like, well, you know, it's like, you know, they're so upset and they're like all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, I can see that. And she's like, this is, it's, you know, and she starts snapping her fingers and she's like, it was so funny. I was like, actually, there's a lot of very funny romance out there. And she's like, really?
Really? What would you say is a very funny romance?
Well, of course, the thing that came to mind were all of the ones that I hate because I'm not particularly into rom-coms.
Yeah.
So, like, the Unhoneymooners came to mind and all the fucking Tessa Baileys.
Well, I mean, I think the thing about Allie Hazelwood is that she's actually funny on paper.
Yeah, she's, like, literally funny.
Yeah, which has not been my experience with those authors.
Yes.
Also,
ditto.
Imagine, first of all, if she has an opinion on there being a lot of angst in romance, she's not a total novice.
Exactly. Like, she gave herself away. I've never read a romance. And I was like, also, you have very strong opinions.
Imagine this being your first romance.
Crazy.
Imagine. The reason that's so unbelievable, or like, would just be a truly bizarre experience. And why it's almost unbelievable that it got published, but there's probably, that probably says a lot, is that this novel borrows a lot from Omegaverse fan fiction structures. This is not our first Omegaverse. We read Deceived by the Gargoyles. One of the key features of Omegaverse, and that's the thing, okay, like saying you wrote a novel with knotting in it is different from saying you wrote an Omegaverse novel. And I think an easier sell, which is bizarre.
That is weird.
But I think it's true. Like, Isabel, would you have been interested in an Omegaverse rom-com? Or would you have been more likely to buy a rom-com with knotting in it? I know I fall into the latter. Even though I know they're the same thing.
That's actually a very good question. Because, like, I think for me, Omegaverse doesn't really mean anything for me. Like I would either have to look it up or I'd have to remind myself what it is. Mm. But like, as soon as you say like alpha, beta, omega, and then I'm like, oh, that's what I'm in. And like, I'm so, I want to say like, I'm so soaked in that language boy. Now.
Oh boy, pun intended.
Pun intended. Like, I've been reading fucking Omegaverse since I was like fucking 14 in fan fiction. Like, I didn't know what it was. Like, I didn't have its name at that time. I just knew that like Alpha's the leader of the pack and like his beta's his stupid best friend and like his fated mate and he has to bite her or smell her or whatever. Like, the nodding came in later.
That's not necessarily Omegaverse.
Okay, so what's Omegaverse then?
So Omegaverse and Shifter romance mm-hmm. are a little bit tricky to parse.
Okay.
But Omegaverse actually has to do with has come to do with the configuration of gender. The reconfiguration of gender, which often occurs almost entirely in fan fiction. So most people attribute Omegaverse to the Supernatural fandom. I went on AO3 just...
The TV show Supernatural.
Yes, which is about werewolves.
Right.
It has werewolves in it. Demon hunting werewolves.
Mm-hmm.
And
as one does.
And wolves have certain...
Pack orders.
Well, they have the mythology of pack orders that have been largely debunked. The guy who wrote on pack orders, there's a great You're Wrong About episode on it. He was observing wolves in captivity, which meant he was observing wolves with very limited numbers and also traumatic existences.
Right.
Because they're in captivity. So actual wolf packs don't have this kind of rigid structure. But the idea being like the alpha is like the wolf in charge. He's the one who gets to mate with all the females. And then there's
the one female.
I'm talking about wolf packs.
Yeah, it's a mated pair. The alpha wolf doesn't mate with more than one. The whole point of the alpha pair being mated is that you don't want multiple pup in a breeding season. You only want the one litter.
Only mate. Do alpha wolves mate for life?
No. They don't mate for life. They're just like a mated pair. So like if one of them dies, they'll find a new mate.
BBC Earth says they do mate for life as a way to submit their position as pack leaders. But that might be in the wild. Anyways, this guy coins all these terms in reference to wolves. And it becomes a part of the public mythology of how wolves operate. A romantic mythos of how wolves operate. And then this kind of gets adapted in fan fiction. And one of the things that starts happening is it allows same-sex couples to have reproductive relationships. So characters in the Omegaverse have an identity of like man, woman, and then they have a sub-identity of alpha, omega, beta. Betas tend to be, I think betas are the neutral ones. Omegas are the passive ones.
Yeah. Omegas are super passive.
Okay, the breedable and what is it? The submissive and breedable ones. Sometimes they have a uterus connected. If they're a man, they can have a uterus connected through their anus. And a lot of the tainted sexual practices also get adopted into this world, although maladopted. So a scenting is something that happens a lot in Omegaverse, but they usually... make it more romantic than wolves would pee on something to scent it. They make it more cat-like where they're like rubbing glands on things rather than canid to mark their mates to other people. And of course, nodding, which is when after completion, the penis becomes bulbous at the base to ensure or to like take out an insurance policy on successfully breeding. And that's nodding. As of recording on St. Patrick's Day, on Archive of Our Own, there are 45,456 works tagged with nodding, which is just one tag. The earliest work that has that tag currently is from June 24th, 2000. And it's a Xander from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. fan fiction.
I wonder if that's the episode where he turns into a hyena in the pack.
Maybe it is. Maybe it's based on that.
They kill and eat a teacher in that episode.
Great. Yeah, and it's interesting. So, but nodding often gets, that obviously predates. So that might be a post they went back and added the tag. Because what they were doing might appeal. But suffice to say, it's been around for a not inconsiderable amount of time.
And not inconsiderable.
Yeah. And it does vibe with shifter romances. Like those of Nalani Singh, is that right?
Absolutely.
Where it borrows a lot from animalistic practices like biting during mating, which rabbits do as well, much to my childhood chagrin. Some people argue that it is now so uniquely situated as to be its own genre entirely. Like, it's not really fantasy. It's not really sci-fi. It's its own particular poison. What's remarkable is that this is not like a widely published. It's mostly fan fiction. It's mostly online, if not entirely. People can have different kinds of genitals in the Omegaverse. They can have multiple genitals often, or changeable. It's a very interesting way of looking at gender expression, but also pregnancy, because pregnancy is kind of the fulcrum on which this idea spins.
Right, like the ability to breed.
Yeah, someone wanted Sherlock to be able to get Watson pregnant. This became a necessary renegotiation of identity to make that happen.
Man.
And why did they want Sherlock to get Watson pregnant?
Because they wanted Sherlock to have sex with Watson?
You don't have to have sex to get pregnant.
That's what I was just thinking about.
I mean,
the Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You don't have to get pregnant to have sex. You don't
absolutely not, but also the other way, right? Like the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito movie, Danny DeVito gets Arnold Schwarzenegger pregnant.
Yes, artificial insemination, yeah. I mean, of course they want them to have sex.
Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't
why
want Sherlock
want
and Watson?
Why do they need to add the element of childbearing?
Man, okay. So I feel like that should be its own special episode because I have a lot of thoughts about why people add pregnancy to things. And mostly it's just to raise the stakes. Like,
well, I think it's crucial here because this book does not involve pregnancy making. It doesn't even talk about it. It does talk about nodding. It does allude to the function where it's to keep his cum inside. Spoiler alert. But it doesn't talk about like what the natural, it kind of gestures towards it, but it never specifically says this is a breeding project.
Right. And there's kind of an open question about whether or not cross species.
That direction.
Breeding can function. Yeah.
It's interesting because pregnancy is kind of like all around the periphery of this novel. There's the question of interspecies reproduction, sexual reproduction. There's the question of the knot and what it's supposed to do. There's discussion of birth control, even virginity.
Yeah. And there's like this really weird discussion that felt like the conservative cipher of like falling birth rates in the vampire community, where it's like, we're not having enough children and the wares and the humans are going to outbreed us.
Like humans, I read something else the other day that like positioned human. Oh, I read something else. A fucking ACOTAR, where like the utility of human beings is their ability to reproduce a lot.
Yeah, in this scenario, we're the bunnies and the supernaturals
are not. The only strength human beings have is in their numbers, which is interesting that this keeps getting reconfigured in fantasy novels because being alive in 2024, you do not feel a lot of solidarity with your fellow human beings. And so this idea that like solidarity and great numbers is like our only strength against supernatural forces feels extremely prescient, but also insulting. Like I get a little defensive when I'm like, surely humans have other utility, have other strengths over werewolves and vampires besides their ability to procreate rapid in greater numbers.
Vampires in this universe think we're crafty.
We're especially good finders.
Yeah, dude. Humans are such Hufflepuffs in this configuration. The real political play here is between the vampires who have a childbearing crisis and the werewolves who don't, but are newly making an alliance with the humans that is going to disrupt the power order.
Yeah. The vampires already have an alliance with humans that is managed via this mutually assured child destruction process where they have a baby diplomat go and live amongst the other species from the age of 8 to 18, and then they bring in another one. And so they're like, we're going to get this diplomat process. The vampires want to get this diplomat process off the ground with the werewolves as a way of circumventing a alliance between human and werewolf. Mm-hmm. And that's why Misery, the daughter of a big deal councilman, is betrothed and wed to Lo, the alpha of the Southwestern Pax. Mm-hmm. We return to Santa Fe.
The new alpha.
Yeah. The new alpha of the Southwestern United States Pax.
And he seems like a cool alpha. Like, he's taken away the gladiatorial murder for fun. He seems, you know, the shorthand of making Lo, like, good guy was pretty funny, where they're like, he doesn't want more wares to die in a single combat. He wants, you know, he's a political strategy thinker because he's the one who's coming up with this alliance with the humans who just had an election for a new, not vampire controlled governor. He populates his gorgeous mansion that he built for his mother and architected himself with, like, adorable younger packmates that he takes care of, plus this old guy Mick, who, you know, is like a advisor of some type.
Yeah, the good duke trope exists here. And
yeah, absolutely,
with Lo 100%. And, you know, obviously Misery has a bad dad, but this novel is freighted with tropes. What tropes did you pick up on?
So, forced marriage.
Bad dad, good duke.
Bad dad, good duke. Forced marriage, forced proximity, fated mates. I also wanted to, like, throw in, like, a soupçon of mafia, because, like, that felt really strong in terms of, like, how powerful the, like, specific bloodline families were interacting.
Yeah, 100%. The kidnapping.
The kidnapping. It actually felt like the mafia novel that we read that took place in Vegas. Like, yeah. We're, like, geographically similar.
The implied violence.
Yeah, all the time. The implied, yeah, like, assassinations. Also just, like, the money that both the vampires and the werewolves have.
The mysterious money.
Yeah.
Mysterious money is 100% a mafia romance.
Right?
Flag. This is extremely astute of you, Isabeau. This is spot fucking on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I feel like political romances, I feel like real, like, a political romance outside of, like, Red, White, and Royal Blue or whatever that would exist would be so, like, upsetting and boring. But there's something about the mafia romance, which is a political romance. And it also feels, like, historically political because it's about, like, the exchange of virginities. that really makes politics more interesting. And I think if the Democratic convention,
which takes place this year in Chicago,
yeah, could add an element of fated mates, maybe they could make their party more relevant. And certainly don't do anything like taking a strong stance on the political needs of the many. Just create some kind of romantic tension. Okay, so mafia, bad dad, good duke, fated mates.
Are there others that you were thinking of? Yeah. Like, I mean, these are the ones that were top of mind for me.
We have virginity. First boyfriend, only boyfriend. Shifter romance tropes. We have a mystery afoot. A mystery overarching impetus to get our couple together, get our Misery to agree to marry Lo, although the argument is made that she might Omegaverse stuff, right? Nodding. She also does the thing where she assumes he hates her.
Yeah, because she smells bad.
She assumes that he thinks she's gross because his pupils dilate.
Very much Bella and Edward in the science classroom.
Yes.
When she's like, am I smelly? Because his reaction is so strong and so visceral.
Yes, exactly.
And continues to be. Then she starts taking baths all the time. She's like, does that help? And he's like, my condition is unchanged.
Yeah. The I'm so gross, he must hate me. I'll try to stay out of his way. When he clearly... wants her deeply.
Yeah, like everyone knows it.
If I may jump to my weirdest part.
Please do.
This is the trope out of everything. Like, I mean, look, there's a lot of entry points. Isabeau and I gestured for weirdest part. Isabeau and I gestured towards the pregnancy, the biological breeding necessity of it all, which is the bedrock of Omegaverse, I think. But we might have to do a separate conversation on that. I mean, the fact that their sexuality is so conjunct bestiality, this is something we've talked about in our other shifter discussions. Like, this Omegaverse makes it much more, I think, explicit.
I also think the fact that she's a vampire made it much more explicit.
Yeah.
Like, that just, like, exponentially did the thing for animalistic stuff.
Why is that?
Because she's literally feeding on him.
Oh, yeah. Her vampire-ness. Right. Well, I think for me, her vampire-ness, to me, I was like, oh, she's a supernatural being that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas her supernaturalness being in proximity to, like, just wolf stuff made it clear that it was much more, like, animal adjacent, you know?
I see what you're saying.
I had this whole crisis, not to get off track with my weirdest part, but the side quest weird part. I was thinking about why animalistic stuff is so resonant in romance, because I've been reading a lot of fantasy lately, and there are lots of people who change into creatures, and they have, like, traits and qualities of those creatures. But no one talks about how their sex manifests in human form. And in fact, a lot of times these shifter creatures, which would not even be called shifters in most fantasy, I don't think, at least not in what I've read, they are almost like sexless, which is honestly how we think about animals. Like, I see baby animals, but I don't think of, like, passion and longing in the animal kingdom. And shifter romance and Omegaverse, by extension, definitely are about longing, which is one of my favorite things to read about. And it made me think, like, why does the sexuality of animals, why is that interesting to us, capital U, not you and I, like, everybody, yeah. Right? Because these are
the us in the genre.
Yeah, this is an extremely popular and well-trod board. And it made me think about how there's this line in the novel where she thinks he's disgusted with her still. And she points out that he eats bunny rabbits by the litter. And it made me think of when my brother's dog found there was, like, a little bunny warren under a bush, and he started sniffing the bush, and Adam was like, oh my god, that's so cute. And then he just heard, like, a crunch crunch, and it was like, oh shit, your dog is an animal. You know, like, your dog isn't a folder photograph of unlikely animal friendship. Like, it's a dog. But then there's also something about the fact that our lovers are human beings, which means betrayal and opacity is kind of part and parcel to having a relationship with another sentient person. And there's something about, like, the rules of the Omegaverse that reflect that, right? Like, nature, and, like, are we beholden to some kind of biological imperative? And also makes it transparent. Like, the rule, you can follow these rules. And I think there might be something appealing about that. I mean, certainly there has to be something appealing for someone to kind of quasi, the guy who came up with alphas and stuff in Wolfpack was doing a lot of solving for why. How about that on his own?
Sure. I think there's something to this idea that, like, especially like feeling in love with someone sometimes can feel really out of control, and it feels out of our norm of experience. Mm-hmm. And so putting those sort of like uncontrollable feelings that are often much bigger than like our normal day to day into the opacity of animals that also have instinct. Like, I think there's something here about like that, especially the freshness of a new romance that like does feel instinctual, mm-hmm. in a way that like at least most of my modern life doesn't feel.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't feel like I'm functioning on instinct so much as habit. So I think like that might be part of it. But I think you're right to say like this little nougat is like it's playful, but it's also just like what you said about the rules, like the rules of the animal stuff feel fairly rigid, mm-hmm. especially when the like where the wares are concerned. And like that also like, I mean, like has its own kind of comfort, right? Because it's like, here's your syllabus, this is what we're gonna do. Mm-hmm. But that also makes it fucking weird.
It does also make it fucking weird. I think this does actually get to my weirdest part. I think I actually found an inroad here.
Okay.
In that your pet is always going to be an animal, so you can never, like, pets versus animals, lovers versus human beings. You'll never really know who you're lying next to every night in the same way you know yourself. And that's something that is incredibly difficult to reconcile for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's just too much of a window into myself. But I think there is something else about the fact that these fated mates, these mm-hmm. the scent that overwhelms and creates love is not socially determined.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think we feel out of control when we fall in love. I mean, I know we do. We feel overwhelmed and everything, but that the choice of who we desire is a choice. To a great extent, it's certainly informed by our culture. It's informed by our all sorts of things that are outside of our control, but nonetheless dwell within us. The thing that's really more so outside of our control is how well we fit into that social system of desirability. And what this idea of fated mates does is it supersedes that.
Mm-hmm.
In Bride, there is no social need. There is no other determinant that these two people should be attracted to and fall in love with each other. In fact, it's actively harmful, a la Romeo and Juliet. And it's not because she's beautiful, although she is. And it's not because he's handsome, although he is.
Though he is.
It's because there's a biological need that's outside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing about like, oh, he's so disgusted with me, but then he's actually in love with me,
mm-hmm.
I think coincides with that more often than it doesn't in fated mates, where someone's like revolted by me. They hate the way I smell, when in fact they love the way it's like extreme mm-hmm. desire is interpreted as repulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And that also feels like a reconciliation of bad feeling because there's a point at which she talks about him being an entirely different species from her, which is literal. Like, that's not metaphor. Mm-hmm. Well, it could be in the novel. It's not in the world of the text. Like, they are completely different species. And one thing you and I talk about is, like, I feel like a different species from certain people
mm-hmm.
who are so beautiful. I feel completely isolated. Like, I know I have a different lived experience than them, but I do. I feel like an entirely different species. And I think during adolescence, this is cranked up to about 15 million. And adolescence mm-hmm. is often, you know, when people start writing fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly when they start exploring Omegaverse fan fiction. But I think we do carry those insecurities with us. And there's something about feeling isolated from the social capital of beauty and desirability to a certain extent, or limited in your own social capital in that way. A good way to gain more of it is by being with someone who has more of it in our lived experience. And I think some of Fated Mates and Omegaverse is this fantasy that your social situation can be superseded and you can transcend your social capital via a biological imperative. And that's really fucking weird to me. That makes me feel extremely... The idea of someone being treated with repulsion, like Edward Cullen is way worse than this mm-hmm. guy. This guy just has big pupils, and for some reason she doesn't know what that means. But Edward Cullen literally like... Bleh, 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 you know? If someone's doing that to you, stay away from them. They're not going to secretly mm-hmm. like you should not... This desire for repulsion to be
something else,
some kind of repressed desire, is very mm-hmm. uncomfortable, especially for me to reckon with, especially mm-hmm. because it does come from this place of desiring more social capital, feeling isolated from it, and wanting some kind a way to transcend it, I think is where it comes from. And that's like an incredibly icky, vulnerable feeling.
Yeah, I think
to read.
It's an icky and vulnerable feeling to read, but it also gets to this like sort of he's only being mean to you because he likes you.
Yeah.
Which are like pretty damaging narratives mm-hmm. that like I was certainly fed as an adolescent.
Yeah.
And I know that like that's not a unique experience. Yeah. And it's weird to see it in a very popular novel in 2024, which actually just perfectly dovetails to my weirdest part.
I would acknowledge that it's in a lot of novels.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not unique.
This is the first time I've felt it so explicitly.
Yeah, because it's like while. It spends a lot of time. First of all, because the structure of the novel is first person, and we get these little like mm-hmm. like epitaphs at the beginning of chapters, which are in Lowe's perspective, but it's usually mm-hmm. not more than a sentence. But this is all first perspective in Misery. Mm-hmm. And so we're entirely in her experience of him, which is revulsion, and then her reaction to it, which is to bathe and to avoid him and to, like, you know, make him comfortable.
Her interpretation is revulsion. I feel like right. as a reader, it's really clear that it's... sexual desire.
Absolutely. That he's like holding himself back. Like he's white knuckling the counter at multiple points. Like,
yeah.
Misery does protest too much.
Yeah. Yes. 100%. It's a little obnoxious, but it's, you know, part of the genre.
Right.
Yeah.
And part of the characterization of like how could Misery be that obtuse is like she's lived an entirely isolated life where people truly don't like her mm-hmm. because she lived with humans and she had exactly one friend and she has a bad dad. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't understand normal affection or like desire.
Yeah.
So that's why she's so dumb. My weirdest part is kind of along these lines of... And it's not just this book that I've now noticed. It's like Allie Hazelwood's oeuvre.
Mm.
All of the female main characters, all of the heroines are sexual novices.
Yeah.
In this book, she's like straight up a virgin.
Oh, yeah.
But in the Love Hypothesis, she's had like two partners in her short novellas, like the one that's based on the handsome Skarsgård brother, which I know doesn't really narrow it down, but... He played Eric in Shubhan.
Least handsome in an interesting way. The most
yes,
straightforward.
The most conventional.
Conventionally,
yes, the
exactly,
most conventionally attractive Skarsgård brother
I would say,
fanfic.
I would say Austin Butler doing a Stellan Skarsgård impression might be in the running for the most conventionally attractive. No, that's not true. That's Alexander Skarsgård is still more conventionally handsome than Austin Butler.
Yeah. Austin Butler's lips are so pillowy.
Especially with Austin Butler's bald cap and milk skin.
But like she's had one other partner, and you said earlier in this episode, like first boyfriend, only boyfriend. Mm. And like this seems to be a thing now. Like I've read enough Allie Hazelwood that it didn't come as a surprise, but it like doesn't come with good feeling for me. Mm-mm. And like, I would say that this book tries really hard to not freight
virginity,
to not freight virginity. Like Lo doesn't really comment on it. She doesn't really have a feeling about it other than she's like, I lived with humans and they're the enemy and like vampires hate me. So like, this is why I've never had a sexual partner.
Yeah.
But like what it ends up doing is recreating like Duke books and mafia books and like all these other tropes that do have this thing where it's like you've hermetically sealed your sexuality for your perfect partner who also is like much more sexually like mm-hmm. experienced than you are, but also has a dick that knots. Like, you know? And so like not only is like the knotting experience new, but all of the sexual spectrum is new to you.
Kissing is new to her.
Kissing is new to her. And I like, I don't love that. I don't love what it like, because this book isn't about saving yourself. It's not, no. It's like, huh. It's not an abstinent first like novel. And that's not its reason. That's, yeah. That's like not, it's really trying not to do that.
It's really trying not to.
It's really trying not to.
When you said like mafia romances, like historical romances that really freight virginity, but also have, especially mafia romances, have an older virgin main character, that really was generative because it made me think of how is this different? Because it does feel different to me, I think is what you're getting at.
It is different.
I think it's almost.
Can you say more?
So our main character is 25 and she's never been mm-hmm. kissed before. And the novel does not shy away from the fact that this is from extreme isolation, social isolation. Mm-hmm. I think this novel also doesn't shy away from the fact that this is a contemporary romance novel. She gets married in a wedding jumpsuit, which is going to be incredibly dated in 5 years. Mm-hmm. And we had this discussion. There was once on Twitter, since our podcast has existed, someone saying, I'm tired of people acting like it's not normal to be a virgin in your 30s.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that conversation.
Yeah. And it's like, well, if you're a person who wants to have sex, and there are people who don't, so, you know, I think a lot of them try it out, but.
Sure.
There are people who have zero interest and don't try it out. Virginity after a certain point does come from some kind of isolation, mm-hmm. some kind of restriction. And that's uncomfortable. It feels like, I guess that's it. Like, it doesn't come from like living a normal life of, well, normal, but living a life where you interact with other people and connect with other people and make these meaningful, trust other people, have the ability to be vulnerable. Like having sex with another person, if you want to have sex with another person, requires a lot of important interpersonal navigation. Mm-hmm. And it also requires a lot of nuance for the most part. Mm-hmm.
And give and take and like things that are like both important for yourself, but also important for like your
it's a developmental and benchmark.
Right. And it's like the way that you like interact intimately with others. And I this is also making me think of that thing that your beloved mother says. It's like, if you're not old enough to call it making love without laughing, maybe you're not old enough to like engage. And like,
she didn't say that. She just said we couldn't call it anything goofy. We had to say making love or sex if we talked about it. But that's a great rule, though.
Right. Like, I've made up an entire narrative. If you can't laugh without saying making love, maybe like you should just like wait. Or like investigate. Right. Like at the very least, investigate. Like, and I think like part of what's hard for me about this kind of virginity sort of like throwaway is that she's never been kissed before because she's been extremely socially isolated. And like Lo just like sort of blows over the fact that she's had exactly one human friend and like one friend, period. Mm-hmm. And there's some stuff here that I think like is like worth excavating a little bit.
Yeah.
Versus like when in Pride and Prejudice, Mary's like, a girl's worth is her reputation and her virginity. And when she loses or breaks it, she's worthless and ruins her whole family. Like, at least that's true.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like that doesn't need a ton of excavation. It's just like fucking terrible.
Yeah.
Versus like there's a series of personal and interpersonal choices and non-choices here that have led to this outcome where this like human being seems very fragile. In like extreme. Very particular ways.
Extreme, yeah.
And like maybe adding nodding sex on top of kissing and touching and fondling is like worth more than like not a conversation.
This is, you know, it's like going from You gotta walk before you can run.
Yeah, dude.
And but that you gotta walk before you can run also reminds me of the fact that like sexuality is so tied up in extremes now compared to when we were developmenting when we were growing up, you know.
Canting.
Yeah. Sex was much more like making love, you know. That's the other thing. They refer to sex all the time as like fucking. Mm-hmm. I am kind of down on that. I just think, mm-hmm. you know, it can be and that's cool. But I think if that's mm-hmm. your like main frame, language frame for sex, that is troubling. But to me, it just sounds so aggressive and like, well, I mean, that's the other thing. Like Omegaverse is predicated on extreme expressions of traditional gender roles. Just mm-hmm. taken out of that, and not even like it's just put into a explicitly biological context rather than something like gender identity.
Yeah, and I think this book it magnifies it in really particular ways, yeah. right? So you've got the fated mates, you've got the Omegaverse nodding, and then you also have this vampire thing where she like wants to bite him like during a sex act, yeah. and it like heightens the sex act itself. And then she like calls her twin vampire brother and she's like, hey, what do you think about like biting people when you have sex?
Does something There's happen? Because like, she comes the first time she drinks his blood.
Right. And so her brother's like, oh, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do blood play and sex because your feelings are going to get really muddied. And like,
I didn't even think of it as blood play. I'm so sick of the term blood play. It feels like
sorry,
it should
like,
have
what else should well, I have called it? Should,
I just feel like what's bodily, like once you open a vein, maybe don't say play.
Okay.
Maybe be
fair.
Like,
bloodletting. Blood like, letting, and there's this blood, point where she's like, I've taken too much. Like, you're going to exsanguinate this fucker. Like,
do you
please
have,
stop.
You need to sterilize the environment. Like,
she did not.
No.
She absolutely did not.
Well,
like,
she
opened that
vampire.
Aorta.
I mean, human sure. beings are doing, like, talking about blood play. And it's like, mm-mm. oh, boy, I feel like you should take it more seriously. Blood profession.
Blood exercise.
Blood project. Blood praxis.
Blood praxis. But like all of this then is like, none of this is predicated on her virginity, but much of it is predicated on her ignorance.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't like that.
I think her brother says, she asks him cagily because he's her brother mm-hmm. and she experienced probably her first orgasm.
Yes.
While drinking this guy's blood. Oh, no, she masturbates. She talks about that. Mm-hmm. She masturbates to completion.
But of course, her masturbation isn't as good as when somebody else is touching her.
Of
which
course.
Is like, all right.
Which is like, you're 25.
You should masturbate better. But like, this is like part of my thing here.
But okay, so her brother, she starts to cagily ask her brother, this her twin brother, and he says, I went through puberty in the vampire world. I know what happens when you drink blood. We are not having this conversation. Mm-hmm. Which I think is, and he kind of casually, he realizes he has a responsibility here and he throws in like, we don't drink from the same person because it limits our breeding potential because we have to be able to have a lot of partners. And the more you drink from someone, the more monogamy becomes mm-hmm, a biological mm-hmm. imperative.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Monogamy as biological imperative actually fixes a lot of problems, I think, for women in heterosexual women in society. Because, boy, heterosexual men are really insisting on non-monogamy as biological imperative nowadays. So maybe this is a little bit responsive to that. But he says, you know, I think it's interesting the blood drinking is almost a way for her as a vampire to share in the mating process, but have more control over it,
mm-hmm.
which feels like a very easy metaphor for boys and girls together. As a woman, she has more control over her sexual desire and her, or not just her sexual, not her sexual desire, but her need for emotional connection. With sex.
Something like appetite.
Something like appetite. Something like, I think it's there to like give her agency.
Yeah, I think it is.
And remove him from his.
But even when he's in control of it, because he's like, take more, take what you need. I'm like, ugh.
You're like, what?
I'm like, ugh.
Does it just feel like too indulgent or like at someone else's expense?
Moreland has a real streak of self-sacrifice in him that I don't super duper enjoy. Like, he's like good Duke writ large, but like
martyr,
absolutely.
Yeah,
which is, you know, I guess that was my second weirdest part, but
martyr complex.
Yeah, because he does this stupid thing where he's like, go on, git, I don't really love you.
Yes, absolutely. And it happens suddenly.
Very suddenly.
After they have penetrative sex for the first time.
For the first time.
I would say, before we get into sexiest part, I'm going to go ahead and acknowledge, I think this is an incredibly well-crafted book.
Yes.
It is better than any other Hazelwood that I've read, which is, for me, I mean, like, technically better. Like, I feel like there's not really a wasted word, but that ending is fucking rushed.
Yeah.
It is rushed.
And there's no reason, like, everyone and their mother would have read another 50 pages.
Of
like,
this, take 100%, your time. Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't understand why you're doing this. Like, you have the clout. No editor is going to be like,
they let you publish with a fancy. This cover has foil on it.
And yeah,
it has
like
Omegaverse tropes inside. You could have done whatever you wanted.
And you could have written Lonesome Dove length novel if you wanted.
You could.
If Sarah J. Maas has taught us anything, it's like, once you have punctured the stardust.
Yeah. The other thing Sarah J. Maas has taught us, endings are hard.
That's true. That's a really, really, really astute point.
You can't just keep running your way to an ending. But I do feel like this one could have been. I read this all in one sitting last night until the wee hours. So I suppose I should be grateful that there's not 50 more pages, but I would have dug it.
Same.
But yeah, he does like a full-blown he doesn't want her to feel obligated to him, and that's like, it's not like he's trying to protect her or save her from anything. He just wants to be chosen, which is an interesting angle to add to an Omegaverse novel. And yet again, I feel like, is this meta, or is it just slippage? Is it meta or is it slippage? What do you think, Isabeau?
I think it's slippage. I think he has a really, what I thought was a moving speech halfway through, where she's had the misapprehension that his mate has been sent to vampire land as the collateral, as she is the vampire in werewolf land collateral.
Yeah.
And, you know, she feels bad because he must love this other creature so much, and it must be agony to be away from her and worried about her.
Yeah.
And he's like, none of that's her responsibility. All of that is my responsibility. And like, I, you know, there isn't anything that she couldn't offer me that I wouldn't take, even if it was just like a smile. Like, her happiness means that much to me. And I was like, that's a lovely speech. Thanks, Allie Hazelwood. Straight into my heart chambers.
Yeah.
And then like, to have it spoken is one thing, and it was like fine, and there's like this like beautiful little rooftop scene. But then to have it enacted almost violently after the first penetrative sex scene, where he's like, I am going to enforce your freedom on you. I don't even like you that much. I'm sorry you misinterpreted all of the scent marking, all of the biting, all of the fucking. I'm sorry that you got that wrong, but like, this isn't what this is. Yeah. It's like, now you're a liar.
You know, and I think another indicator of slippage, I wasn't mad at Lo when it happened. I was mad at the book.
Yeah, I was absolutely mad at the book because it also seemed out of character for Lo. Like, he's not a liar.
And that just seems like a stupid strategy.
Yeah, it's like, she's going to fucking figure it out, dude.
And I will be led by the nose through any text. And so if I get mad at the text, it's probably a pretty egregious betrayal.
Yeah.
Because I'll be like, wow, this whole time it was taking that. I buy it completely.
No, but for him to be like, go on, get.
Yeah.
I was like, you fucking.
Yeah, 100%. He tried to old yeller her.
Yeah, I'm just like, this isn't
the relationship.
And she's like, of course, totally fucking devastated. And she's like, what did I do? And it's like, that's another reason why the virginity thing fucking sucks, where it's just like, it wouldn't have been different if she wasn't a virgin, but it also just made it worse that she had zero sexual experience.
Yeah. And so this is like their last interaction before the
climax.
Before the climax. And then they don't see each other until well after. And she goes back to his house and she sees all of her stuff packed up in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she assumes he's trying to move her out.
Yep. That's a fair assumption after their last interactions.
And then he's like, no, I put your stuff in boxes so we could move it into my room. But I don't want you to move into my room. Like, it's just so, it is slippage. It is transparently slippage. I was rooting for you. We were all rooting for you. But Isabeau is right. It's just not a good.
Sloppy.
It's not good. It's not a good reconciliation. And that's tough. Them's tough breaks. I mean, listen, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you what your sexiest part was.
Great question. I don't want to take the bathroom scene from you.
Well,
so.
Please do, because it's not my sexiest part.
Okay. I did really love the bathtub, but my sexiest scene, end stage capital. Fuck me. When he slides, so they have a private plane. They have this political meeting. They have to go meet this saboteur in California.
This is not the bathtub scene.
It's not the bathtub scene. Because, like, that was good. But, like, my sexiest scene is the scene in the fucking private jet.
Well, now you're taking my actual sexiest part. Oh, it's not a private jet. It's a Cessna.
It's a Cessna.
It is a private plane.
Like, fucking name branding a fucking private plane. And then not only that, he fucking pilots it. And then they, like, land on the tarmac and he's like, wait, before these goons show up, I have to make you, like, important to me and, like, have to scent mark you. And, like, he's just, like, rubbing his nose all over her neck and, like, behind her. It's just like, oh, my God, I just... Can you, like, just, and that was, like, the most mafia scene, too, where they're, like, on the tarmac and they're, like, doing this, like, weird scent marking, super sexy thing while the goons are, like, waiting for them. So there's, like, also this heightened sense of danger, which just, like, heightens then the tension, which then heightens then the scent marking kissing thing that they're doing. Second, great.
I will push back on the late capital thing. I don't think sure. You should hold yourself accountable there, because Cessna aircraft tend to be hobbyist aircraft.
Okay.
Manufactured in the great state of Kansas.
I didn't know that. Good job, Kansas.
And while they can have rooms such as are described, I think she says it looks like a cross between business class and a waiting room. Mm-hmm. That's pretty accurate. Like, it's pretty utilitarian. And I think it's actually significant character building for Lo that he's not some billionaire. Like, she makes the joke, like, honey, are we rich? And of course you're rich if you own. I mean, you're well off if you own a hobby aircraft.
And that you've spent the time to get your pilot's license. That's a very expensive hobby.
Yeah, it's a very pricey hobby. But it's more of a creative, generative hobby than some guy who flies a private jet.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit hotter.
Yeah,
significantly sexier than like a fancy. I don't know if I just increased the eroticism for you by.
I mean, it was super erotic when he slipped, like, because I also it was like a surprise to me. And like, that's one of the genuine pleasures of first person done well. And Allie Hazelwood does first person extremely well.
Yeah, she does.
Where it's like I felt the frisson of pleasure of seeing him be extremely competent. And it was also a surprise. I was like, because when they got to the tarmac, I was like, all right, where's the stewardess? Where's the pilot? Where's, like, you know, the trappings of this?
None of that.
And he's like, it's me.
It's me. I'm flying the plane. I'm flying this little hobby aircraft. The other interesting thing is she talks about the fact that she's never been on a plane before.
Yeah.
Because vampires and werewolves are largely banned from airlines.
I do love that the humans still control, like, air travel.
That's
and, like,
our
the
other,
FAA. It's like, we're good at breeding. We still have the TSA and
breed.
Bloodsuckers and werewolves are not allowed.
Yeah, we can breed and twist. We're the only ones who can fly.
Commercially.
But yeah, I thought it was dreamy that he had. I also like, I mean, I like fully. I fully got into it when it said Cessna. I was like, like, he got it off of Craigslist.
He's looking for a deal.
He has to vacuum it out himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was extremely appealing way of handling a private flight. And I loved how he's nervous to explain to her the nature of scenting her for her. He mm-hmm. has to do it for her own protection. Mm-hmm. But he likes her a lot, obviously. And it's an inherently sexual practice. And how do you articulate that to someone you have a crush on? Because mm-hmm. you really want it to happen. You don't want to scare them off. But also you have to be honest with them about it.
Yeah, like, what informed consent is important.
And what a giddy soup he was stirring for himself leading That's up true. To the scene itself. It was perfect build up, earned.
Yep. Yeah. Chef's kiss.
Just one of the top sexy scenes, I would say, of the year so far.
So far.
But the year is young. Well, I'll go ahead and address the bathtub scene, as is my okay. brand. I want to talk about two sexy parts, I guess. So while they're in California, she has gotten used to enjoying baths. I feel pandered to at this point. I feel like we are reading so there's been a modern renaissance of bathtubs.
I agree.
And I'm not saying people are writing them because I like them, but I feel pandered to nonetheless.
There's so many more bathtubs in the last 5 years. I swear to God. It is like... was like, okay, we have rediscovered bathtubs.
So she starts bathing because she thinks her scent grosses him out. Mm-hmm. And baths do make you smell incredible. Add a little bit of your perfume to the bath water, then add your perfume to your lotion, and then add some more perfume. It'll be the best you've ever smelled. But she's trying to cover up her smell. But she comes to enjoy baths because baths just mm-hmm. should take up more of your time. And if you're essentially in a hostage situation, a bath is a
good
way.
Got a lot of time to kill.
It's better than twiddling your thumbs.
Yeah.
So she's taking a bath while they have a just one bed situation, except she sleeps in a closet. Mm-hmm. So nice try. But she's taking a bath while he's out on a run as a wolf with his mentor. And when he comes back, he knocks on the door to ask if she's decent. And she says yes. And she creates a bubble, a foam modesty
chemise.
Blanket. Yeah. Which, of course, doesn't work. Anyway, somehow he ends up, while he's talking to her, he's shirtless also. So it sounds like two people with the same plan. And he ends up holding her ankle. There's a lot of ankle mm-hmm. holding in this novel in general. Holding her ankle and scuffing his knuckles along the bottom of her feet.
Ugh.
And there's another bathtub scene that is more explicitly sexual. But this mm-hmm. one, and it also has tender ministration. So I kind of thought that was the direction you were going to go in. But when he's just having a casual conversation, that is the subtext is incredibly sexually charged with a little foot touching.
Mm.
It's nice. Mm. I don't trust people who are disgusted by feet.
Yeah.
I think they want them too much at that point. Mm. That's my assumption.
So a revulsion of feet is really a revelation of desire.
Yeah, I think so. Oh no, I'm the problem. Oh, no. I'm the problem. Thou doth protest too much.
Thou doth protest too much. No, I love feet. I love having my feet touched. I don't mind touching other people's feet.
No.
I grew up in a foot rub house, though. Like, my parents would rub each other's feet all the time. My mom offers to rub my feet all the time. Like, we're just generally touchy, but also, like, not foot averse. And, of course, my toddler is obsessed with having her toes kissed, which I am happy to oblige.
She can still kiss her own toes. Good for her.
She does do that, but she wants others to kiss it. And now she's she's in this like phase where she's like learning to take turns. And then she wants to kiss my feet and she'll like literally take my slippers off to kiss my feet. Anyway, that's enough about my kid who I'm like clearly forming a foot fetish for.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, you and I both have serious feet, but in opposite directions. We both need a lot of professional foot care for different reasons.
True.
That's an interesting, keep that in your back pocket. Womance super fans will know.
Yeah, Womance super fans will know.
Feet are Morgan, fraught.
They are.
All right.
They do a lot of work.
I mean, it's obviously a Womance for me, Bride by Allie Hazelwood. I would recommend it to a lot of people. I think it's interesting in our current moment, seeing a book like this get published feels like a real apex for fan fiction in the culture TM. And a real, it could be a point of rupture. I don't know.
We'll see. I think we're on a new, like we're on a new part of the mountain. And so like,
yeah,
whatever that will mean for fan fiction, I'm curious. And like what that means for publishing, I'm also curious. Like this particular text doesn't feel like more important than 50 Shades of Grey, but feels more nuanced and true to what fandom is than 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
And so like, I think that's a particularly interesting space.
Yeah.
I am excited. Like, it's a new vista. How about that?
It's definitely a new vista. And I think positioning it alongside, you know, on a timeline with 50 Shades of Grey is interesting because this is kind of, I think, the first mainstream Omegaverse publication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at once already reckoning or attempting to reckon with what the implications of the Omegaverse are, I think, which is clear by the fact that she drinks his blood, that they don't use Omega and Beta as terms in this novel, that it's already being reckoned with in a certain and edited and nuanced and massaged. Also speaks to the rapidity of media, especially romance media.
Yeah.
Because 50 Shades of Grey was a blip. It wasn't that long ago.
That's true.
It was a blip in time, not in...
not in publishing or like zeitgeist.
No.
Yeah. It's a romance for me too. Highly recommend. Allie Hazelwood is very funny. And for some reason, I never hate her for... I never tire of her first person, which is...
incredible.
A feat. Yeah.
Incredible for you.
It is true.
Would you be surprised to know that the first 50 Shades of Grey movie came out 9 years ago?
No, that seems exactly right, because the book came out like almost 20 years ago, like 2005, 2004?
2011.
That's the movie. When did the book come out?
The book came out in 2011, the first book. It's
no.
Yeah, the first movie came out in 2015. It is currently 2024.
That seems fucking nuts.
And it existed, I think, as fan fiction before 2011, but...
oh, for sure. Oh my God, it was fucking published in 2011? God, I was super off. I wonder why. Weird. So weird. Originally self-published as an ebook, print on demand in 2011, and then published in 2012 by Vintage Books.
Yeah.
We're so far out of, like, that particular moment of self-publishing, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Rapidity is a good word for how fast both technology and, like, dissemination have moved.
Yeah. How many years ago was 2011?
15.
Children born in 2011 have learner's permits if they want them.
Yeah.
Just for context.
That's crazy.
Driving cars. They're on the road with you right now. Children born... the year that 50 Shades of Grey...
2011 is 13 years ago.
Children born the year 50 Shades of Grey is published are going to PG-13 movies without parental guidance right now. They're sitting next to you in the theater. They're buying popcorn with their own walking around money.
Yeah, mom and dad dropped them off.
Oh, look out, y'all.
That's fucked.
What's the world going to be like 13 years from now?
26 years after 50 Shades of Grey.
Who will we be?
Who will we be?
Probably flying cars. Isabel crossed her fingers.
If I don't have to go through the line at the TSA, I would fucking do something pretty egregious for a flying car.
Why don't you just get TSA pre-check?
I need to. What I need to do is get global entry, but the interview at fucking O'Hare is like 3 months long. So
don't you also have to interview for TSA pre-check?
That's $90 and something else, but I want global entry because I want to do stuff. But anyway,
Stuff. Don't be vague about what you're going to do with global entry.
I just want to travel globally more easily. That's it. I just want to travel globally more easily. That's like, especially with a toddler and a stroller, I just want to go fun places more easily. That's it. That's the thing.
Being vague anything on a podcast about what you want to do with global entry is how you end up on a no-fly list.
That's true. That's why I need to get a Cessna. This podcast really needs to take off. We need to do more ads.
Too exotic for you to play games like this, Isabel.
With the federal government. You're right. You're right. This is why you're my friend.
I'm looking out for you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else to be said about Bride by Allie Hazelwood besides it's a generative discussion?
No, this is good. I don't have anything else to say.
You feel at peace with what you said?
I do.
All right. Left no knots untied.
We unknotted all of the knots. In ourselves and the text.
All right.
With that.
Loosen your knots.
But never your principles.
Woly guacamole, everyone. Thanks for listening to another episode of Womance.
Womance is hosted and produced by my friend Morgan.
And by my friend Isabel. Our logo artwork is by another friend, Mary Reichman. You can find her on Instagram at m.reichman, spelled R-E-I-S-C-H-M-A-N-N.
Original music by Nick Gravlin.
Editing and mixing for this episode was done by Steve Keel.
And our web mistress is Jane Bonzak. They're the best.
You're also the best. We so appreciate your support by listening. Please consider taking this to the next level by following, rating, and reviewing. We read every single review. Or even check us out on Patreon.
If you'd like more woe in your life, you can connect with us on Instagram at womance and on Twitter where we are at @mance_woe. Or you can find more episodes and content at womancepodcast.com.
If you have an idea or just want to reach out, please email womancemail@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Womance is a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to add to your romance collection at frolic.media/podcasts. Until next time.